Most people know that Law Matters was created to open the lines of communication with law enforcement, as well as create educational opportunities so we can be better, more informed citizens. For the last several months, all the news stations have been promoting a negative mindset towards the entire law enforcement community. I agree that some of the recent events are beyond egregious. However, those events do not represent the vast majority of the brave men and women who risk their lives daily to keep the rest of us safe. I'm asking you to please, next time you see a member of law enforcement, show some appreciation and thank them for their service. Now, let's start the show. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. We have on the show today James Traynor III, who is the chair for the Federal Election Commission. Can you hear me, sir?
I can. Can you hear me?
I can. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
I did. It was great. Lots of family over.
Did you do all the cooking?
I did some of it, not all of it.
Well, very cool. Okay. As soon as people found out that you were coming back on, I was inundated with comments and questions, and I sent you 4 or 5 pages of, oh my gosh, look at this.
Can
we start going through this and see what happens, what kind of answers
Sure.
we can get?
Sure.
Okay, first I want to know, because I know you've worked a lot of elections, is this the most fun you've ever had?
This has been one of the busiest election seasons ever, given that you have the number of recounts that are going on. I thought 2016 was going to be a record breaker, but clearly 2020 has been a record breaker on that front. So, you know, with recounts in Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, what's going on in Pennsylvania, what's going on in Nevada, even some challenges that are happening there in Arizona. It's been record breaking.
So you're working 16-hour days trying to keep up?
It's difficult sometimes to keep up with everything that's going on, and the legal pleadings are flying left and right, and you try to keep abreast of everything that's happening and who's going where and that type of thing. But it's very busy.
So I know there's been a lot of cases that have been thrown out of court, and like around 40, something like that?
Yes, something like that.
Okay. Isn't it a problem when you keep filing frivolous lawsuits?
Well, there's a difference between a frivolous lawsuit and one that's been dismissed because it's moot, or one that's been dismissed because the issue is no longer ripe for the court. We have to remember that under our federal constitution, there has to be an actual case in controversy. So, for example, if you sue a state in order to get a recount, but the state then later agrees to do a recount, your case is obviously moot at that point and your case is dismissed. So your case wasn't frivolous because you were asking the state to do something and then the state doesn't do it. And in fact, in the law, we have something called the catalyst theory, where the filing of a lawsuit actually causes something to happen that you wanted to have happen based upon the lawsuit. So your lawsuit was actually the catalyst for it happening. And in some cases, there are attorney's fees that go along with the catalyst theory for filing to force a state governmental entity to take some sort of action. So the other thing is, cases have been dismissed in some circumstances because they've been consolidated with other cases. So, we file on one or two subjects, separate lawsuits. The court decides to deal with those as one big lawsuit as opposed to two smaller lawsuits. And so the two smaller lawsuits get dismissed because they've been joined into one. So, nothing that I've seen so far has been frivolous. I think they've all been legitimate claims that have been made. It's just a matter of procedurally how they're handled in the court. So I think it's a misnomer for people to say that these are frivolous lawsuits or that they haven't been effective in what they were trying to do.
Well, there's a lot of people that are saying there was no evidence, there was no basis to file the suit to begin with. Is that what you're finding, or are they just, we want to recount until we can change the numbers? I don't know. What are they doing?
Well, clearly there's a difference between the recounts and the lawsuits. I mean, a recount is a legitimate right that every candidate has, and in the circumstances of Georgia, You had a recount that was mandated under state law because of how close the election was. And then you have the ability of a candidate to ask for a recount after that recount is done. And those are two different recounts. The original one is just a machine recount, so they rerun the computers to make sure that you get the same answer from the computer the second time. Okay. And then the third time is actually a hand recount where they actually print out ballots, and they're actually allowed to go look at the backup documentation for mail-in ballots, such as signatures and identification and those and dates that they came in, some more detailed recount that's gone on there. Of course, in Wisconsin, they're only on their first recount in Wisconsin. And Michigan, they did a recount in Michigan. There's some unique laws in Michigan that make a recount somewhat impractical up there, which is why you saw the Wayne County Board of Electors refuse to certify their election. So lots of things going on with the recount. Lawsuits, on the other hand, bring challenges to mostly are challenges to equal protection requirements that are specific to federal elections.
So once a vote or a state certifies their vote, you can't challenge that any longer, or
It really depends upon where you're at jurisdictionally. I mean, since every state is responsible for their vote, in some states, in order to start a recount, you actually have to have an initial certification of the vote to start a recount. In other states, you can have a recount before they certify the vote. So it really is a state law-driven mechanism in order to determine when and how a recount is conducted. So the certifications are really just a procedural step more than anything else in the process. What everybody needs to understand in what we have going on right now is that the legal challenges and everything will continue up until a winner of the presidential election is declared. And, of course, that does not happen until the votes of the Electoral College are counted in the new Congress in January.
Okay. I heard on the news, and I don't know how true it is, that you know what I'm going to say, right?
I don't, but that's okay.
That Trump wanted people to, the Electoral College, to declare him the winner. How practical is that?
Well, it is a possibility, and the reason why is because the U.S. Constitution gives specific authority to the naming of electors to the state legislature. It is only through a grant of authority from the state legislature to the voters that voters are actually allowed to vote on who their electors are. And this is where the confusion in presidential elections comes in with the Electoral College. You go in and you see Donald Trump and Mike Pence on the ballot and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris on the ballot, and you think that's who you're voting for. But in fact, you're not voting for those particular individuals. You're actually voting for an elector who will vote for those individuals at your state electoral college. And at any moment, and it really depends upon state law, but for in most cases, the state legislature could at any moment change the law to say, we are taking back the authority to appoint our electors to the Electoral College, and they can pick whoever they want to be the electors for the Electoral College, and then those electors would vote in the Electoral College. And then, of course, it's the House of Representatives that opens the ballots cast by the Electoral College to determine the winner of the presidency. And it's the Senate that opens the ballots that are cast for the vice president to see who's been elected as vice president.
Has there ever been an elector that's been bought to vote a specific way?
Not to my knowledge, there hasn't. There were several attempts in 2016 to force to ask people to be what is, and that's someone known as a faithless elector, who votes different than what they had committed to voting to prior to the election. There were several attempts to ask people to not vote for Donald Trump last time. I don't know that anybody tried to bribe them or pay them off, but there was a lot of pressure put on those. In fact, in Texas, you know, there were two electors who did not show up at the Electoral College to vote, as faithless electors. So that was an issue in 2016.
What happens when they don't show up?
Their votes are not counted. I mean, so you end up with two less electors for the state than what the state's been allocated. It's an interesting situation. Now, Texas has a provision that regardless of in state law, there's a provision that regardless of how many show up, Texas reports its full number of electors based upon the majority of votes in the Electoral College in the state of Texas. So you know, you had two that didn't show up. It really didn't make a difference one way or the other. All of the electoral votes went to Donald Trump in 2016. So, but again, that varies state by state based upon what state law says for handling of the Electoral College.
Do you think the Electoral College has outlived its usefulness?
Not at all. In fact, without the Electoral College, we would see elections that were only run in New York and California. Because if you were running purely on a popular vote, all of the money and all of the time would be spent where the population is. So if you lived someplace other than one of probably the four largest cities, in the country or the two largest population states in the country, you would never see a presidential candidate. They wouldn't spend any time advertising to you. They would care less what your vote is. And your vote would be completely irrelevant in all of those places.
Okay. So there is a purpose, even if they don't show up. Now, what I'm wondering, they didn't show up. Is there some kind of, do they get in trouble with the state? Or is this, you know, they don't get paid to be an electoral person. So, or do they?
No, they don't. Well, most states don't. I mean, I don't know the rules for all 50 states, but, I believe all cases, all states don't pay them.
Okay.
So they may get some travel reimbursement funds or something like that, given the distances that they have to travel to the state capital.
So they're not going to get arrested for not showing up.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay. So these recounts that are going on, how many times do they have to recount before somebody says, okay, that's enough. We've recounted everything like a bazillion times. This is the result.
Well, so in Georgia, for example, this third recount, which is the one that was actually requested by the Trump campaign, that's the only time you get to recount it. The one that's going on in Wisconsin is requested by a candidate. That's the only time you'll get to recount that one. Pennsylvania would only have one recount. You know, so it's whenever the candidate requests it, they get that recount. And, you know, we've seen the multiple recounts as a function of state law requiring, because of how close the election is,
right,
that they verify. You know, even in Arizona, they had what we call the recount was an audit of the vote. And again, that's a function of state law where the vote is so close that the law dictates that it be audited to make sure that we got it right. That wasn't necessarily a recount that any party requested, although various parties participate in the audit and watch the process play out.
Okay. They were trying to make, or there was talk about making D.C. a state.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work out? And how would that work?
Well, so in order for only the federal Congress can admit a state into the union. So D.C. frequently has referendums to be admitted as a state. So they petition through a vote to let people know that they would like to be a state. But it takes a vote of the House of Representatives and of the Senate, and then the president has to sign off on it for a state to be admitted to the union. So that would be a question for the incoming Congress in January as to whether or not they would want D.C. to be admitted as a state.
Okay, and they don't have a sheriff's department there, do they?
They don't. So the District of Columbia is controlled. Remember, it's controlled by, it's actually controlled by Congress. It has been handed over to, Congress has delegated authority to a local mayor and city council, which is elected locally there in D.C., and they do have a Metropolitan Police Department. Although, given what goes on in D.C., there are several other law enforcement agencies there, most notably the military police, because the District of Columbia actually is a military district more so than it is a state or a city.
So who would serve the eviction notice?
The
if Trump decides he's not going to leave the White House because he seriously believes he won the election, who would serve the eviction notice?
Well,
do we send in the flying monkeys?
No, I would assume that you would have some sort of court action at that point. And it would be the U.S. Marshals who would be responsible for sending in any order from the, enforcing any order from the court.
Awesome.
Yeah. Although I would tell you, I mean, you know, there's very little that control that the even the U.S. Marshals have in that particular situation. If you remember back in our history, you know, it was Andrew Jackson who disagreed with a ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court that John Marshall had handed down. And his famous quote is, you know, Mr. Marshall has made his ruling. Let him now enforce it, is what he said in that particular situation. And so it's, you know, there is a history of presidents ignoring the rulings of the U.S. Supreme Court. So
it's because they're special. We have a caller, Chris. What's on your mind?
I wanted to get the gentleman's opinion on what he thinks about the voter spikes in Pennsylvania when 600,000, 500,000 votes came in for Biden and only 3,200 for Trump in the middle of the night, and also his opinion on the Dominion voter machines. And if he knows, because there's just so much information going out there, pro and con, on both sides of Democrats and Republicans. And I'm hearing that there were Ethernet cables connected to the Dominion machines, and they had Internet access. And they also have the capacity for having a back door that you can get into, and you can also cover your tracks. Also, I'd like to get the gentleman's opinion on what he thinks about the 47 USB cards that are missing. And the fact that they found a USB card that had 50,000 votes for Biden on it, and there's still 47 of those suckers floating around. So there, it just seems like this election, no disrespect, but they really dropped the ball on this. And I think we need election reform yesterday. And I honestly think that the way they did it in Iraq is they dipped their thumb in ink to show that they voted. And I really hope that it doesn't come to that here, but everyone I know does not have any confidence in this. And something's got to be done about this, because this is our system. This ideology is like a cancer in our government right now, and it is eating it away. And that's exactly what the foreign actors, and you know they're out there, that's what they want. And I get emotional about this because our country's on the line.
Okay.
Well, I certainly appreciate the caller's passion, and in fact have that same passion. I mean, I would say that the transparency of our elections really is the cornerstone of our republic, and the allegations that have been made need to be investigated so that Americans can have confidence not only in this election but in future elections. With regard to his first point on the 600,000 ballots in Pennsylvania, there has been direct evidence provided both to the legislature and to the court in the form of hundreds of affidavits that there was fraud that took place in the Pennsylvania elections. I think that's why you've seen the call by the Pennsylvania legislature to address that issue. The chairman there, who was blocked by Twitter yesterday, in fact, is calling on the state legislature to actually take back the process of appointing their electors because of all of the fraud that's there. With regard to the second part, the missing USB drives, Again, that just goes to the transparency element that we have. If you cannot find the equipment that was used on election night to get to the total that you have, then you cannot be 100% confident in the outcome of the election. If you cannot do a recount where you have 100% confidence that every vote has been counted, then you have to look at what other remedies are available. And, of course, we know from the Bush v. Gore litigation that the only remedy that's available then is to look to the legislature for either, A, whatever process they've set up to handle the circumstance, or, B, for them to take back the authority to appoint the electors themselves. And with regard to the call, with regard to the Dominion voting systems, the Dominion voting system being used in several states is problematic. I mean, it's known to have flaws. I'm originally from the state of Texas. I know that the state of Texas didn't certify the Dominion voting system for use in Texas because of the concerns over its ability to be hacked. I think what you see is that the Dominion voting system probably costs less than other machines, and therefore, it's being used by several states because of an economic standpoint. And I would really urge those states to get in contact with the Elections Assistance Commission at the federal level, where I believe there are still monies available from the Help America Vote Act back in 2001 for states to acquire new machines. But it is the machine that the state decided to use. And, I know ES&S has said there's been no problems with their machines, but, based upon all of the evidence that we've seen on the ground and based upon the allegations that have been made in the lawsuits, that were filed yesterday, I think it's important that Dominion, address those issues. And I think it's going to take probably court action for the courts to find out whether or not the actual level of fraud took place.
Okay, I don't know if you know, we have interns on our radio show, and Maya from the University High School has a question for you.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think what you referenced in the beginning, the like spikes in votes, or there's kind of allegations of fraud, that there was fraud in the Pennsylvania election. However, like the federal appeals court rejected Trump's request for an emergency injunction. So, So does that mean that they're denying any fraud allegations, or that they believe that there isn't like sufficient evidence to prove that there was fraud in the election?
No, so the denial of an emergency, I mean, first of all, you have to remember that an emergency injunction would be, at law, would be what we would call an extraordinary remedy. It would mean that if we, the court, don't take any action, things are going to be turned, there's going to be so much upheaval that we'll never be able to figure out what actually happened. So the denial of an emergency injunction is really not that big of a deal. It's to be real honest with you, for most lawyers, it's a long shot to get a pre-litigation injunction in a case. And so it's really just the first step of having the court take a look at it and having an appeals court review the denial of an emergency injunction. It's also, from a strategic standpoint at the law, it's a quick way to get your case in front of the Supreme Court. Because you do have facts that are asserted in an application for an injunction, and those facts can go in front of the Supreme Court as to whether or not the emergency injunction should have been granted or not. There is an element in there of likelihood of success on the merits. That's one of the elements on the issuance of an injunction, but it's not the primary element. The key element is the court's ability to maintain the status quo. And given that the votes had been cast and that all of the evidence was located in one location, and it, you know, they had the ability to recount it, they had the ability to control what was happening with all of the machines, with all of the ballots, those type of things, I'm not surprised that the court said we're not going to give you an emergency injunction against going forward with the processes, especially given the timelines that you're dealing with here. I mean, the states have to be finished with this process by December 14th. I mean, they lose the ability to vote, certify, and send their electoral college votes to Congress on December 14th. So for the court to hold it up for any period of time could have had the opposite effect of maintaining the status quo. So it doesn't surprise me that early on an injunction was denied, just given that it's an extraordinary remedy.
All right. Yeah. I have another question, if that's okay.
Sure.
So this will all be, you know, like the American people will know December 14th, essentially who's going to the Electoral College and like what states are going to Donald Trump and what states are going to Joe Biden. Is that what you're saying?
They should, and I'm not going to guarantee you that they will. So it is possible for a state to not meet the deadline of December 14th for their electoral college to meet, and that state's electors would not be able to vote, and they would not have votes that are transmitted to the House of Representatives to be opened and counted in January when the new Congress is seated. And that has happened in the past in American history. It's also happened in the past in American history that the Electoral College vote is tied when it gets to Congress. It's happened twice in our history where the votes are counted by the House of Representatives and there's a tie in the Electoral College. And in that particular case, the House of Representatives meets by state delegation so that every state has one vote. In that circumstance, here, given the makeup of the new Congress, the Republicans would control the House of Representatives by state delegation. And so you would see President Trump elected by the delegates voting by state in the U.S. Congress.
Do you think that's fair?
Well, it was certainly fair when Thomas Jefferson was elected that way, and it was certainly fair when Andrew Jackson was elected that way. So I think it's the rules of the game as they are stated before the game starts. And so, you have to play by the rules as are stated. If somebody wants to amend the Constitution going forward, clearly the states have the ability to do that. But that's the system that we have in place.
Well, it's been working for how many years? So
yes,
I guess
exactly
that's how we need to live by that. Let me ask this. If a state ratifies their election, does the candidate who's upset for losing still have the opportunity to demand a recount?
At this point, probably not. The time frames are pretty tight on filing recounts. So if a recount hasn't started by this point, we're probably beyond statutory limit of when the recount can be asked for.
So everything has to be done prior to. A lot of people are curious because we know Trump is millions of dollars in debt. And the longer this goes without being ratified, he can continue to raise funds. And I noticed that he gets 60% of the money raised and the GOP gets 40%. Is that legal?
Yes. So in under federal campaign finance law, the national parties and candidates are allowed to enter into what's called joint fundraising agreements. And so when the fundraising appeal is made, it's disclosed to the donor that there's an agreement for the money to be divided up amongst whoever it may be. In some cases, you may see it divided up between a candidate and a state party. You may see it divided up between three or four different candidates, or you may see it divided up between a candidate and a national party. They're called joint fundraising agreements. Those agreements there's some statutory language that has to be required for the agreement itself. And then there's some disclosure that has to go to the donors when the fundraising appeal is made so that the donor knows that the money is being divided up that way. But they're legal and they're used very, very often in federal elections. And you see them happen a lot with both presidential campaigns raising money for both the candidate and for the national party. You'll see it on the, you know, the Senate leadership side. You'll see money going to both the candidate and maybe the Senate Republican campaign committee or the Democrat campaign committee, and same thing in the House, with money going to the candidate and the various parties' congressional committees that they have.
So when the money goes to the candidate, are they allowed to spend that money as they want, or is it required that they spend the money on campaigning in the cost of running an election?
Yeah, so the one big overarching thing that they're not allowed to do with campaign funds is to personally benefit from the campaign funds. That's the big no-no under campaign finance law. So they can't personally benefit from it. So yes, it does have to go to specific campaign-related activities. So they can't, you know, they can't use it to make their car payment. They can't use it to make a house payment.
Or go on vacation.
Or go on vacation or do any of that type of stuff. It has to be used specifically for campaign-related activities. And to the extent that they're in debt, even if they've loaned themselves money, there's a provision in federal law. It's currently being challenged. It's actually sitting in front of the Supreme Court, but by a senatorial candidate. But under federal law right now, the maximum amount that a candidate can pay themselves back in campaign loans after the campaign has ended is $250,000. So if a candidate's loaned themselves, you know, $10 million after 30 days after the campaign, the most that they can pay themselves back is $250,000.
Wow. Okay. We need to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few. Please stay with us.
Daylight is fading and the temperature is dropping. You're not only cold, hungry, and lost in a densely wooded area, you're injured. Time is of the essence. SARCI is a highly trained team of dedicated volunteers who work closely with Pima County Search and Rescue to help people in critical situations just like this. To join an exclusive team of heroes, go to SARCI.org. That's SARCI.org. We need your knowledge, experience, and of course, your generous spirit.
Hi, I'm Maya Thompson, producer for the Law Matters live show that airs Saturday mornings at 8, when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. On our next show, Drug Enforcement Agency Special Agent in Charge, Cherry Oz, answers your questions. This show depends on your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. If you missed us live, check out Law Matters on iTunes, Google Play, and of course, lawmatters1030.org website. Now get your questions ready and join our conversation at 790-2040.
Hi, this is Sherry. If you think your current interest rate is high and refinancing is on your mind, give me a call at 520-310-9900. Maybe you're thinking about purchasing a new home while rates are low. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. Perhaps you just want to know how a reverse mortgage can improve your life. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. I can help you with all your mortgage needs, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
This is Nathan Chabon, producer for Law Matters. I have a goal to reach, and I need your help. I want to put the DEA out of business. That's right, the Drug Enforcement Agency. If you have an addiction problem or know someone who does, please reach out to lawmatters1030.org and click the DEA tab for more information. Reaching out is the first step. We have the resources if you have the will. You can beat this demon and help me put the Drug Enforcement Agency out of business.
Law Matters is paid for by Law Matters Nonprofit Organization. The views expressed are not those of KVOI or its sponsors.
Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is the chair for the Federal Election Commission, James Traynor. And I have a question about, I think you know, we were inundated with questions, so I'm trying to get through as many as possible. I have a question about his nonprofit in raising all these funds, doesn't he have to have a mission statement that, you know, people are aware of when they contribute?
I don't know which nonprofit you're talking about.
Because he has so many.
He has several nonprofits. And with regard to the president, I mean, the president's not involved in any of his business activities because his current private businesses are held in a blind trust. So he's not involved with any of the business activities that go on with his individual businesses. If you're talking about a political action committee that he's created,
right?
The political action committee does not have to have a mission statement. A political action committee is assumed to be supporting or opposing candidates or political issues for purposes of what we do with the Federal Election Commission. So it's presupposed that it's designed to support a candidate or oppose a candidate. And if it has the name of a candidate in the name of the political action committee, it's assumed to be supportive of that particular candidate.
Well, the thing that I read said he wants to save America, but it didn't say from what or who.
Right.
So what are we saving America for?
Yeah, so that's just a political action committee. And it's, as long as the money is raised within the federal campaign finance limits and reported at the appropriate times to the Federal Election Commission on whatever reporting timeline they chose when they created the PAC, then he's perfectly within his rights to do that.
Okay, when he filed to run for office in August, he filed 228 trademark application requests. He was granted 21 of them. So every time you buy a bumper sticker or a t-shirt or a hat or whatever, he's got that trademark, so he's making money. How do you address that?
Well, it depends on who owns it. It all comes down to who owns the trademark in one form or another. So if it's his private business that owns the trademark, then his private business is the one that's making the money. And again, those are held in a private trust that he doesn't have. I mean, in a blind trust that he doesn't have control over currently, as long as he's president. If it's the campaign itself that holds the trademark, then the campaign would be the one who would receive the funds from the use of the trademark license.
Yeah, these were filed by Trump, so he's the one that holds it.
Yeah, so it would be his individual trademark. So whatever money's made there would go into the blind trust that's being managed on his behalf by whoever the trustees are.
Do you think Rudy Giuliani is doing a good job?
I think Rudy is doing a great job, actually, and I think that the people of Arizona are going to get to see that on Monday with this hearing that's been announced that's taking place Monday morning in the Arizona legislature, where they will get to see the evidence that that Mayor Giuliani and Jenna Ellis have put together on questionable activities that took place in the Arizona election with regard to the counts and things like that. So I think your listeners will be able to get a firsthand view of what kind of job he's doing.
Will he be here in Arizona, or is he going to do this from afar?
If Pennsylvania is any indication, he's going to be doing it actually there in Arizona, because in Pennsylvania he actually presented at the legislative hearing. So I would assume that he's going to be there. He and Jenna Ellis both will be there to present the evidence and the witnesses that they have to the legislature.
So what exactly is the complaint with Arizona?
To be real honest with you, I don't have all of the details of what went on. I know there's concerns over the count in Maricopa County and some irregularities there. Most of what we've seen in the western states has revolved around people who are no longer residents who voted in the states So you have people who, for whatever reason, were registered in Arizona. They show up on as having voted someplace else and yet still having voted in Arizona. And so, you know, you kind of have to run those to ground and find out whether or not they're still a resident in the state of Arizona. That used to happen a lot in Florida until there were some, Florida made some drastic changes to their election law. But there used to be people that voted in both Florida and New York or Florida and New Jersey all the time until Florida was able to clean up their voter rolls and they entered into an agreement with other states that kind of checked the clearing of their voter rolls and worked through that process at the state level.
Wouldn't cleaning up the voter rolls be something that's prudent to do prior to the election?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, and in fact, there are several organizations who focus on doing that. And you would be surprised at the amount of animosity towards them that there are. I mean, they get accused of being racist and they get accused of trying to disenfranchise people all the time. But the National Voter Registration Act requires states and counties to do a periodic review and cleaning of their voter rolls. And most people are surprised to find out that the counties and the states don't engage in that activity. And so there are several outside organizations that come in and file lawsuits against counties for not cleaning up their voter rolls. You would be surprised at the number of counties in the country that have more people registered to vote than there are that actually live in the county. That's even when you include military and overseas citizens who are absent from the county. So it's very common for there to be more people registered to vote than actually live in a particular place.
Do you think COVID had any effect on this election?
I think COVID had a major effect on this election because it allowed for everyone to have such a fear of going to the polling locations that we saw the widespread use of mail-in ballots. And I said this before the election. I wrote an op-ed about this before the election, that the widespread use of mail-in ballots, especially by states that aren't familiar with using that process as a means of voting, we're going to end up in recounts and litigation. And sure enough, we have recounts and litigation going on in lots of places across the country, mostly focused on mail-in ballots, paper ballots that have come in. It's the easiest way to commit voter fraud. It's the most common method of committing voter fraud. It's the most common method of being able to stuff a ballot box is by using a paper ballot that supposedly came in by the mail. So COVID absolutely had an effect on it because, everyone felt more comfortable voting by mail.
Pima County has been using mail-in ballots for a long time. I've been, on their permanent early mail list for a very long time. And they are very strict about who, can get a ballot and where you live, and they double check, triple check. They're very thorough. Why wouldn't other states, I think they should be an example for everybody else. Why shouldn't other states have the mail-in ballot opportunity? It seems like it's an easier way to get people to vote.
Well, whether it is or isn't an easier mechanism, I think the important thing is that the appropriate checks, like you mentioned, be in place, that there be strict requirements on who and how the ballot is obtained. What we saw in Georgia, for example, was just the wholesale mailing of mail-in ballots to voters. We saw the same thing in Texas in Harris County, even though Texas has very stringent laws on who can apply for ballot by mail. The county clerk in Harris County, Texas, sent a mail-in ballot to every registered voter. And of course, there was a lawsuit filed to try to stop that. But once the ballot's in the mailbox and goes out to the voter, it's really hard to get that genie back in the bottle. And you have valid legal ballots kind of floating around out there in the mail, and that's problematic. So the key thing for the states to do is make sure that they have appropriate safeguards in place and appropriate requirements on who can and cannot apply for ballot by mail. Not that it's a bad way to vote. It's just that it's this particular election didn't have the safeguards that are in place. And that kind of gets back to my earlier point of we have to have the transparency in the election process in order for people to have confidence in the elections. And that means the rules have to be set ahead of time, not changed mid election cycle to say, well, this state now is all of a sudden going to be voting mostly ballot by mail as opposed to voting in person how they have in the past.
And they don't have a plan in place.
Right.
See, Pima County should be the example for everybody else to follow.
Absolutely.
So I want to ask you a little bit about the presidential pardon. I don't know if you can address these, but
sure, happy to.
Okay. Can the president pardon himself when he hasn't been arrested yet?
I think that's an open question as to whether, I mean, it's never been litigated as to whether or not he can. There's a professor John Yoo, who teaches out in California, in his most recent book, Defender in Chief, actually addresses that issue. The conclusion that he comes to is that the president probably does have the power to pardon himself at any point, because the Constitution itself puts no limits on the authority of the president to pardon. It is an absolute power to pardon.
Okay.
So it doesn't limit it to specific people. It doesn't limit it to specific time frames, and it doesn't limit it to the only thing it's limited to by specificity is that he can only pardon for a federal crime. I mean, he can't pardon for a state crime,
right.
but he can pardon for a federal crime. That would be the only limit placed on it.
So I'm sure he's going to go on a pardoning spree, and all his friends and family members are going to be pardoned even before they've been arrested for anything. So does it count? Can somebody who's been pardoned, what's his name, Michael Flynn, he's been pardoned. Can he be rearrested after he's been pardoned?
It would have to be for a new crime because the constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy would come into play. So he could not be charged for the same crime. It would have to be a new crime. And of course, the pardon wouldn't apply to the new crime. So they would have to come up, come up with some other charge to bring him up on, but he's been pardoned for the crimes that he was being prosecuted for.
Did you hear the comments that Bannon made about decapitating some people?
I have not heard any comments that Mr. Bannon made, no.
Okay, I think he was supposed to be in jail, but he's not. He was on some media program talking about decapitating Fosse or and somebody else. I can't remember who it was. But I thought, oh my God, what's the matter with you? Why would you even say something like that? Can he get in trouble for threatening these people with obviously bodily harm?
I made in the context of a media interview, probably not. Unfortunately, and I think that's where we've gotten in our culture that it's okay to say things like that. I mean, we've seen comedians who've been pictured with decapitated heads of the president. So,
and she got in trouble.
Yeah, I think unfortunately we've lost some of the morality of our society, and we've delved into this politics of personal destruction a little too much.
Yeah, it's really sad to see some of the things that are going on, and there doesn't seem to be any morals or respect. And,
right.
You know, you're allowed to your opinion, and I'm allowed to have mine. It just seems like it's really unhinged, so to speak.
Right.
So
right.
I know that Roslyn Sergeant Burns is the acting pardon attorney. Is that just a name because he can do what he wants, or are there actual restrictions that she can put on any of the pardons?
Oh, well, no, the pardon authority is the president's alone, so he can pardon anyone that he wants to for any crime that he wants to. The presidential pardon is effective even pre magistration. So, I mean, you look back at the Ford pardoning of Nixon. I mean, Nixon hadn't been out of the White House for very long. There wasn't even an opportunity for anyone to bring charges against him, and yet Gerald Ford issued a pardon to President Nixon. So
I remember that.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, you know, the president has the authority to do that. Now there is a pardons office at the Department of Justice who handles. There are pretty routine applications that come in for pardons from all over the country. For people asking for pardons, and there is a certain segment of the population who pushes for a more expansive use of the pardon by the president in criminal situations, because they think that the leniency of the pardon should be a more key element of our judicial system.
So all those requests go to this attorney, Roslyn?
Yeah, most of them go. Yeah, most of them are processed through the Department of Justice. Some people, you know, send letters directly to the White House, but most of them are processed through the Department of Justice.
So if he's issued a pardon to himself before anybody files a complaint, is he? I just don't understand how he can pardon himself when he hasn't been accused of anything yet.
Well, I don't either, and I mean it's a question of what would you pardon yourself for? But clearly,
he's feeling the need.
Like I said, it's really an untested question. I think were it to happen, I think there would probably be some challenge that was filed to it. So I think you'd probably see a case that made it all the way to the Supreme Court at that point. As to whether or not the president had that authority. But again, it is an unchecked authority given to the chief executive by grant in the Constitution. So there is no constitutional limit on it.
Okay, I've got a question about your position. Are you appointed? Are you hired? How does your position get filled?
So I was nominated by the president, and I was confirmed by the Senate, and I serve a 6-year term on the Federal Election Commission, unless the president at the time when my term expires does not appoint somebody in the Senate, doesn't confirm anybody, in which case I hold over in my position. So I have two of my colleagues on the commission right now. One of them has been on the commission for 16 years. One of them's been on for, I think, 18 years.
So you got the help you needed last time you were here. They had not appointed somebody, or somebody wasn't assigned yet.
So we're still waiting on that. We in order for us to function fully, we have to have at least four. We only have three right now. A full complement of commissioners is six. But the Senate Rules Committee did have a hearing last week or week before last for three more commissioners, one Democrat and two Republicans. That would put us up to a full set of commissioners, and we're just waiting for the Senate to have confirmation votes on them, which they anticipate will happen sometime around the first, maybe second week of December. So here before the end of the year, we should be back to a full complement of commissioners on the Federal Election Commission.
Now, are they going to be able to hit the ground running, or do they have to be trained?
They should be able to hit the ground running. Most of them, the Democrat that's coming on is currently the chief of staff to one of the other commissioners. One of the Republicans who's coming on has practiced both election law and in front of the commission for a long time and is very familiar with what goes on. And then the third one, the second Republican, is an attorney is currently the chief of staff, an attorney for Senator Hawley from Missouri. And so he has some experience with the commission just based on the oversight role that the Senate has with the commission.
So what do you think is going to happen in Georgia?
I think they're going to finish the recount based upon information that I've heard yesterday from the recount. Being able to check, do signature verifications in this recount, there has been some significant change in the numbers of ballots that are allowed to be counted.
and not. And I think the next step after the recount is that you'll see a lawsuit in Georgia based upon equal protection claims, because while all of this is governed, while the counts are always governed by state law, what we know from the Bush v. Gore litigation and the holding from the Supreme Court there is that every county has to do the process exactly the same.
Okay.
And if signature verifications weren't happening the same, then there's going to be a 14th Amendment challenge.
I want to thank you so much for coming on, and I hope to have you on again. This has been very enlightening.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.